and welcome to the IMI's Talking Points podcast. My name's James Skoltok, IMI Motor Pro Editor. In this episode, we're taking a look at some of the challenges the automotive industry faces, specifically how to plug the skills gap. Joining me to discuss how the sector can change people's perceptions of it and bring more talent in is Andy Turberfield, Head of Quality at Alfred Auto Centres. Hello, Andy. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us. Automotive, we have to be honest, don't we? It's an amazing industry, but it does face some fairly significant challenges. And I guess one of the biggest challenges of all is the skills gap, the skill shortages that it faces. The IMI has done a lot of research and work into this, and its latest Future Skills Requirements Insight report provided the top 10 drivers for skills change in the automotive sector over the next 2 years. Now, one of those was talking about vacancies and how we're going to have the highest vacancy rate in 21 years, not a good number, and 5.5 automotive jobs in every 100 is vacant. That could sound quite negative, but from your perspective, working at Halfords, obviously that skill shortage can be compounded by the lack of diversity in the industry as well. So how is Halfords trying to buck that trend and counter the shortage and bring more people into automotive?
I'll certainly agree with your point that it's an incredibly difficult time for automotive in terms of skills. For some time now, people have talked about the skill shortage in automotive. I think the skill shortage is really out there in the EU, in Europe. The skills crisis is actually happening here in the UK in a number of sectors, automotive being one of them. So it forces us, quite rightly, to look outside of the normal recruitment box. And actually, I'm not sure what the normal recruitment box is anymore. Once upon a time, you'd be looking at apprentices coming out of schools and colleges, and they would fit into sort of demographic group, but it's getting harder and harder. And of course, also companies are finding it more challenging to operate apprentice schemes for a variety of reasons. So when you're doing it, when you're setting it up, you've actually got to now look at a much wider and much more diverse population of people to fill these spaces. And I think it's very common now to see that young girls, for example, do very well at school, in some ways probably better at school than young lads. And with technology, the way that it's changing, it can actually be a great career for young girls and females coming into the industry because it's much more relevant to the skill set they have. So literally widening gaze at trying to find new skill in automotive is absolutely vital. As we've talked through the podcast, you know, there are a number of phrases that we use at the moment. And I think one of the most important ones for us is making sure that the businesses that we operate, our workshops, our stores, our Halfords Mobile Experts, reflect the communities that they serve. Because if you want a business to be successful and you want to attract customers from equally diverse groups, then they need to feel comfortable in the environment that the business creates for them. And that's the most obvious way of doing that, is to have a broad, diverse range of people that they can introduce themselves to and feel comfortable with.
Yeah, it must be difficult though, because as you say, you as a business, you need to reflect the customers that are coming through your doors and asking for your services. But let's be honest, the automotive industry has had a problem in that respect, because we tend to, and we still need lots of people to come in, but we tend to attract the same type of people. And obviously they're still needed, but how do we buck that trend and open or cast our nets wider so we're bringing in a wider diversity of people into the industry?
We have to work a lot harder to change the stereotypical image of what the automotive sector portrays itself as. You watch TV programs, soaps, open up a magazine or a newspaper, and what's the stereotypical image of a mechanic that you see? It's either Phil Mitchell or Kevin Webster, and they're usually covered in grease and oil over their faces and their hands, the old overalls under the arches or something like that. And those sorts of images, I just don't think they're reality. Of course, those things exist, but I don't think that's the majority anymore. It certainly isn't the picture that we want to portray. And so I think automotive needs to work a lot harder to change that image. And it has to get out there into schools, into colleges, into people's hearts and minds, into their homes, and really make sure that people can understand that automotive is actually a professional sector, and that all people that work in automotive and garage which is in auto centres and repair centres and so on, are now here to properly look after them and their vehicles, and should therefore be presented in such a way as to provide that confidence. So we've got to work really hard to change that stereotype. And it's going to take a while, but I think we're starting to move that to that oil tanker now, so to speak.
Yeah. And I guess support is another thing, isn't it? In order to bring people in and make sure that they advance within automotive in terms of their career as far as possible, they need assistance sometimes. And that diversity can mean lots of different things to lots of different people. So, for example, you, Halford, sorry, are also working with the First Step Trust, and its work is supporting learners with issues such as anxiety or poor literacy skills and helping them to gain the confidence they need to have a successful career in automotive. So how important are programs like that in encouraging people and helping people into the industry?
It's absolutely vital. There are such a large number of people that are furthest away from employment. That's a term that gets used quite a lot at the moment. And it means a lot of different things, obviously. But First Step Trust specialise in helping people with specific disabilities in terms of anxiety and low confidence, self-esteem. And I was actually introduced to First Step Trust by Steve Nash at the IMI a number of years ago. And it absolutely felt like the right thing to do to get involved. So we began supporting Ronnie Wilton at First Step Trust with training material. We actually learned a lot in working with First Step Trust. That's the other thing that's so important about this. We might think we know a lot, but actually, when you start working with organisations like First Step Trust, you learn so much. And I'll give you an example. Our training material that we use is quite often on a PowerPoint, and we might be in a training room training our technicians on a particular subject. Through working with First Step Trust, we actually invited some of First Step Trust learners into our learning environment to learn alongside our technicians. And I recall some years ago, one of those learners identified to us that they were finding it difficult to read some of the information on these PowerPoint slides because of the different colours of text that were used. Because it was completely oblivious to us that people suffering from dyslexia had trouble with different colours, white on black, white on orange and green and all the rest of it. So that helped us change that. And it's actually, again, you then find out that a lot of motor vehicle mechanics suffer from things like dyslexia. So working with these organisations really does help large organisations like us change our tack, our methodology, our material to ensure that we deliver training to our own people better than what we did before. But you also learn that people learn in different ways. People talk about blended learning. When you've got people working and learning in First Step Trust environment, confidence is a huge thing. And of course, one of the things that First Step Trust has been developing is virtual reality. And what we found with supporting them with content for the virtual reality program is that people can learn in a safe environment, in a safe world. They're not being measured or monitored or looked at by people. They can learn in an environment where they feel a lot more comfortable in. So yeah, and of course, all of this work has culminated in us now employing people from First Step Trust, learners that have gone through the program, worked with us together, and now they are now working in our workshops. We've got a young man that's worked for us now for 2 years, doing a fantastic job, and a few more that have joined our apprenticeship last year. So, yeah, it's a hugely fulfilling relationship that we have with First Step Trust.
Yeah, and I guess those sorts of relationships are possibly something that more businesses should have a look at, because it sounds like they're really mutually beneficial as well.
Absolutely. And a lot is talked about what used to be called corporate social responsibility. A lot of big organisations like ourselves were required, quite rightly, to do things to support social areas. Of course, it's now comes under the ESG ban, environmental social governance. But it shouldn't just be a requirement. It should be a desire, a need. And we've expanded our relationship with First Step Trust to other charity partners. As you're probably aware, we now work with the Palmer Foundation. And the Palmer Foundation, similarly, led by Dr. Andy Palmer, former CEO of Aston Martin, he has an absolute desire to offer apprenticeships to people from disadvantaged backgrounds. And we started working with Andy a year or so ago. And what I found with all of this is that no one entity can do it on their own. Halfords has the employment spaces, the vacancies, if you like, but struggling to fill them. Ronnie Wilson at First Step Trust has the support and the training material and the ability to train people from disadvantaged backgrounds. Andy Palmer, with his huge network, had the access to support methods and entry into organisations, but we still struggled to get the people. And that's why we then hooked up with London South East College Group, who had a really good demographic of young people that were from those backgrounds. So we brought the whole thing together. We call it FAST, Future Automotive Skills Talent. And it's a project we've put together to really use the resources of these members. And of course, the final member was the IMI, because we needed to adapt qualifications to fit the needs of people with learning abilities that needed a different type of approach. And we've now got, we added 8 apprentices to our scheme last year through the Palmer Foundation, First Step Trust, LSEC, and the IMI. And they are doing a great job. And I firmly believe that these young people would never have found a job in automotive if they hadn't have come through the program. And there's a number of reasons for that. Young people might go into full-time education at colleges because they've got to stay in employment until they're 18. And automotive is a subject that is easy to pick. But you look at a lot of these young people and they've got no intention of becoming motor mechanics. It's just something to do. And we did a huge selection program and drilled down to the group that we have, and they are doing a phenomenal job. And like I say, to be able to give something back to a community means an awful lot. And organisations such as ourselves should be doing that. And our plan has always been that once we've proven the success of FAST, to give it to automotive, to enable other automotive businesses to use the programme and help more young people into work.
Yeah, and not to big up Halfords too much, because I'm just the person asking the questions, but Halfords, historically, you've also worked with ex-offenders as well, haven't you? Which is another area.
Yeah, and a number of years ago, again, as that was part of corporate social responsibility before SG came along, we started working with a number of prisons, HMP Onley for one, Ford down in the South Coast. And that was, again, I think automotive then wasn't quite in the position as what it is today in terms of skill shortage, but it was on its way to getting to the point of where we are today. And what was apparent was that when you look at the prison services, what happens to these people when they've served their time? Unfortunately, a lot of people reoffend because they don't have a future when they come out of prison. They don't have the skills. They might be neglected by society. We set up training academies whereby we delivered, I think the automated level 2 at the time, to select groups of prisoners on site with the aim of helping to support them gain employment when they come out. And we actually employed a small number of them following their release. And we continue those projects today in HMP Drake Hall, which is a women's prison. And we've got a cycle academy there whereby we actually send bicycles there to be repaired. They are repaired by female prisoners. And then the whole plan is that they gain qualification and they get a job in our stores when they're released. Like I say, these things, I don't want to big up Halfords too much either, because ultimately, while I work for the company, I very much feel a big part of automotive, but also society as a whole. And it's vital to create a balanced society that we have, when we have the opportunity to do, that we support these people.
Yeah. And I guess the industry is changing, isn't it? So what people may have perceived as being an automotive job in, I don't know, previous years, isn't what it is now or what it's going to be. So with the likes of greater levels of electrification and connectivity in vehicles, it changes what the automotive industry can offer as a career as well, doesn't it? Does that help when you're trying to encourage people to come into automotive as a career?
It absolutely does. We're going through probably the largest technology shift that we have done in the last 100 years. People talk about there's been more changes in automotive in the last 10 than there has been in the last century. I think that's going to continue. There'll probably be more changes in automotive in the next 5 years than there has been in the last 50. You know, but yeah, as we move to a more electrified transportation system with greater levels of autonomy, with advanced driver assistance systems, greater levels of connectivity, I think the young people of today that will be driving in the future probably won't be so much bothered about the size of the engine or the speed of the car. It'll be much more about the, being able to connect to the vehicle and use the vehicle like they do a mobile phone. So all of these technologies open up the opportunity in automotive. It isn't about spark plugs and oils and gearboxes and engines anymore. It's about programming. It's about accessing data. And so that's what I mentioned earlier with young girls at school. It opens up a career pathway for people that wouldn't necessarily have thought of automotive as a career. We have to work so hard now. It isn't just about young people and schools, actually. It's about parents too. For many years, parents, of course, I'm a parent, you want your best for your kids, don't you? And there is a common belief that kids need to go to university to gain a degree and get the best career possible. But actually, a career in automotive through a modern apprenticeship can be just as good, if not better. And so our job is to really make sure that parents are suitably informed, that schools are suitably informed, that kids can see an excitement about automotive. And it's vital that we do this because automotive can be blamed in some ways for environmental issues with CO2 and pollution and so forth. And who wants to join a sector like that? Automotive is going through this huge change and we're trying to make the world a better place. And that really does open up the doors. And you mentioned diversity earlier. Diversity also includes disability. There are people with disabilities, and here I might be talking about physical disabilities, who may not be able to do the heavy lifting that is commonplace in automotive today, but actually are well suited to the diagnostic capabilities, to technology, to data. And we have one of the Palmer apprentices that we've got in one of our centres has got some pretty significant physical disability. But this lad has an amazing talent for accessing data, for drilling down, and he will make a fantastic diagnostic technician and probably a really good master technician in the future, so long as that person has got a program that fits them and is supported in the workshop as we're doing. Physical disability should not be a barrier. It's just about making the reasonable adjustments to help these people to become great colleagues and great people in automotive.
Yeah, and in fact, just touching on that quickly, there was one example of someone I was talking to recently who was blind. And on a lot of job applications, it says that you need to be able to drive, even if a role doesn't require any driving for you to be able to do it. So I guess it's going to take a little bit of logical thinking of how we're advertising jobs as well, so that we capture as many people as possible and the right people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it still surprises me, actually, how many young people don't have driving licenses. We've got young people in our apprenticeships and people that join us as car mechanics that don't have a driving license. And that is a huge surprise to me. But then when you think about it, do young people still look to buy a car these days? And with mobility changing, the ability to go out there and get a car on the street through an app and use it for a short period of time. There is lots of different ways of being mobile now. So you've really got the established order of things is definitely changing. You mentioned blindness. We've got some young people that work for us with autism. And that takes some understanding. But we've got and I can think of an example. We've got a young man in one of our centres that has autism. And the whole team actually comes together to support that young man. And that person has to know exactly what they're going to do for the whole day. And as long as they know what they're doing, that they have a plan, they just get on with it. And the team work around it, and because it's a team of people. So it is about making these reasonable adjustments. It's about being aware, and it's about being accepting. It's about being open. You can't afford not to be now. And a more diverse workforce is an integrated workforce. It's a successful workforce. And like I said earlier, it reflects the community that it is trying to serve.
Yeah. You touched on it briefly when you were talking about the First Step Trust. And again, now I guess with this part of the conversation, but how important is it that you adapt your approach to training to individuals' needs then, so they can get the most out of it and actually be a success?
I think you just said it. It's about being a success. I think it's obviously something that schools and education providers have already realised, that young people now, they don't just learn in one way. I can think back to when I was at school a few years back. You'd be sat in a school behind, sat in behind a desk, watching a teacher on a blackboard with a pointer and a piece of chalk, and the assumption was that was just it. It was established, wasn't it? Whereas today, it's widely known that people learn in different ways. Attention span is absolutely crucial. A lot is made of e-learning, and we have a learning management system at Halfords. We've got lots of e-learning programs to give people information, but we're also acutely aware that the attention span of somebody doing an e-learning program is about 5 to 10 minutes. Anything longer than that and you've lost them. It's also well known that if you're in a face-to-face training course that you'll probably retain about 20 to 25% of what you've learned in that session. So it's vital that the absolute things that you need to teach people are in bite-sized chunks and they're emphasized. And I come back to you mentioned First Step Trust. Like I say, that whole thing about virtual reality, it isn't just a gimmick anymore. It isn't just a game, although gamification is now a learning process. It's a recognized way of helping to teach people. You've only got to look at young people on their mobile phones. It's now a part of life. So you've got to be able to adapt to all different types of learning in order to get that message across. There is no one established way anymore. It really is a full blended learn.
Okay. One final area to cover, and again, we've touched on this already. I guess that's a sign that a lot of these issues are all interlinked. But the perception of the automotive industry isn't necessarily the best. As you mentioned, if you think of a motor mechanic, then a lot of people's minds will drift to EastEnders, for example. The IMI is trying to shift these perceptions with its More to Motor campaign and then highlight, again, as we've mentioned, the vast number of different roles and the variety of options that are open, especially as technology shifts. But I guess, one, how important are campaigns like this? But also, how can Halfords and other businesses help drive the change and help drive the perception of the industry?
Well, it's massively important for the IMI to be doing this. The IMI, as an awarding body, is the professional side of the industry. It's vital that they're able to make this stand, so to speak. But the IMI absolutely needs the support of industry. Case studies, I think, is one of the most important ways of doing this. Real people getting studies together that show what people in automotive have been doing, how they've done it, how they've been successful, because that's real. So when you're trying to portray an image of actually what is now becoming the reality, you've got to get that to the widest reach as possible. And the IMI, as great as it is, can't do it on its own. It has to do it with its partners, with its members, with the companies that support it. And we've all got to come together on this. And I really, truly believe that the more case studies that we can create and put out through the IMI, through Motor Pro, through these types of programs, is vital to get that change out there into the wider community, into the public. We've absolutely got to change this perception. Automotive, let's be honest, is not necessarily a highly trusted sector, is it? People are always a bit, are they telling the truth? Do I really need all this work doing on my car? So on and so on. And there are lots of opinions that people can get. So building trust with the public, with our customer base, is vital. And the more that we can do to show all of the great things that we're doing, how our people are developing within our organization, and the great things that we do outside of that help to build this trust. Of course, we've got to live up to it. But as I say, working with the IMI, the professional face of the industry, is vital. And it's vital that the IMI are helping to support that.
Yeah. In that case, now's your chance. Because like you say, the real people's voices, the real people's experiences are really important. So that being said, what was your route into the sector? How did you get involved in automotive?
Well, I suppose the traditional route. My father ran a small garage in a little village in deepest, darkest Gloucestershire. He took it over from his father, who built the garage in the sort of early 20s. That's the 1920s as opposed to the 2020s. And it really was the cornerstone of the village community. They repaired tractors and bicycles and motorbikes and these newfangled cars that were coming out. And it was always expected that I would join the family business. As soon as I was old enough to hold a spanner, I was in the workshop down the pit fixing things and cleaning out lawnmowers and whatnot. But the weird thing was that it actually almost turned me away from it. I wasn't sure that I wanted it because the environment wasn't great, as you can imagine. It was a little garage and we didn't have any heating and we washed our hands in the stream across the road and all sorts of things. At some stage, I made a decision and I wanted to do it properly. I went to college. I did a full-time education. I did my level three. I actually left my father's garage to work in a larger OEM dealership. I learned a few things about the trade and then I went back to work with my dad. And we worked together for about 5 years before Halfords came along. And Halfords came along when my future wife came along. She arrived one day in a beaten up old Renault 4 and needed it fixing. And I went to work for Halfords in 93 as a car mechanic in Evesham. And I started my real career properly then. And I suppose there was a moment, actually, as I was developing, wanted to get out of being a mechanic, getting my hands dirty. I was about 25 and I wanted to get into management. And I was lucky because I had an interview with my then soon to become mentor. And he asked me a question. He asked me the question, Andy, how would you motivate a technician? And I thought long and hard about it. And I gave what I thought was a good answer. And he looked me in the eye and he said, Andy, that's absolute rubbish. If you want to motivate a technician, you've got to develop that technician. If you develop technicians, then they'll move mountains for you. And it stuck with me. And I was able to progress my career through operational management, through compliance. And eventually I went into training and I was able to turn it on its head and actually use that phrase that I was told all those years ago to create the training academies, build the relationship with the IMI, and do some really great things in training technicians in Halfords a few years ago. Yeah, and here I am today as head of quality, where my role is very broad, but one of my key things is to try and make sure that our customers get what they pay for, our technicians do a great job. And in order to do that, we've got to have great skilled people, great motivated people that want to develop. And it's an absolute joy to be a part of it, I have to say.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to put you on a slight pedestal now, but as you've worked your way, quite literally, haven't you, from the bottom to the top, and you were recently in CES at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, looking at what technologies are coming down the line for automotive. So I guess that's a good example of how far the industry can take you if you want it to.
Oh, absolutely. I think that in automotive, the world's your oyster. It's interesting. In recent times, a lot of people have been putting down automotive a little bit and wondering where the future might lie with electrification and petrol and diesel engines coming to the end of their time and so on. And what's it all going to look like? And I just see it as just a phenomenal opportunity in automotive. I just think it is one of the sectors that is just going to grow and grow. And when people think about what does the future hold in flying cars and all of that sort of thing, guess what? There was a flying electric car in CES this year. So who knows what's coming down the line, but it's hugely exciting and it's something that I'm very proud to be a part of. We're at this sort of this junction in automotive today where we've either got to think about the future or do what we've always done. And I think that those elements of automotive that are wanting to just continue doing what they've always done, that's going to make it very difficult for them. The choice is the future. It's a difficult one to make, don't get me wrong, because it means investment, it means working outside the box, it means working with demographics that you've not worked with. But there are people out there to help you. There are some really great organisations like First Step Trust, like the Palmer Foundation, and many more that are out there that are crying out to work with organisations in automotive to help people into roles that would ordinarily have not had the opportunity. And these people have got so much to give, as we are finding. So my advice is look outside the box and create yourself a much more diverse and inclusive workforce, and you will be an organisation of the future with people that are really bought into what you're trying to do.
Well, great words to end the podcast on. It's been great talking to you, Andy, and a real pleasure, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, James. It's been great. Thank you.